Right, well, thanks very much for inviting me. If I pass out halfway through, it's because I'm going down with some terrible lurgy, so that's why I hope you don't all go down. I'm not spreading northern germs as well as everything else. So I hope I make it through it. If I don't make it through it, just carry on reading the handout, because that's more or less what I'm going to say, so that's why it's so long. And right, so that's the fallback. And the title's on Science, Pluralism, Economics, and it's, as I say, it's part of the work that I've been doing really on the work of Otto Neurath and his role, which isn't so well known in the philosophy of science. He's known for his role in the Vienna Circle and the Unified, you know, the project for the unity of the sciences. But his debates in economics, because he was primarily an economist, and in particular, I'm focusing on some letters that he had, correspondence that he had with Hayek in the 1940s, which is unpublished correspondence. And basically, this paper's more or less based on rummaging through people's letters. Right, so it's some stuff on there. There's some letters with Carnap, which are relevant. And there's also some letters. It's great. I mean, it's kind of sad. It's when you really get to the geek thing. I found some letters with G.D.H. Cole recently in Reading, which I think were really interesting. And so I'll come to those at the end. And it's part of a series of papers I'm working on towards a book with Thomas Hubel on Neurath's philosophy and its relations to his economics. And this is one of about three or four papers that I've done on Hayek and Neurath. And they explore a variety of themes, some of which you've mentioned. I mean, there's a theme about the ecological limits of markets. There's a theme about knowledge, science, and markets. And there's another theme which I'm going to focus on today, which is about pluralism, science, and economics. And in unpicking that, I mean, part of the larger project is really to rescue, and I think this is part of a logic project that's been, a lot of work's been done here at LSE, in fact, of rescuing the Vienna Circle from a certain kind of picture of its account of the relationship of science and planning, right? Which really comes through, on the one hand, the Frankfurt School, right, and I can talk about that in discussion, and the other through Hayek and the Austrian economist and Popper. So it's a kind of partly a kind of exercise in rescuing it. Because this is all unpublished letters, a lot of the time, what I'm going to do to start off with is just kind of, well, for a lot of the paper, is just outline what Hayek's arguments were and Neurath's response. And then what I'm going to do is try and focus on what I think can be rescued from Neurath, from Hayek, and why I think it's still of continuing relevance, why it's not just a historical story. So I hope I'm giving you more than just, you know, someone's letters, you know, done as a piece of history of science or history of philosophy here. So the background to the debates then is, by the way, someone got a watch I can borrow. Oh, it's the clock there. Right, yeah. Background to the debate is an essay by Hayek called Scientism and the Study of Society, which was published in Economica in a series of papers between 1941 and 1944, which were really aimed against, you know, scientism, physicalism, positivism, and Neurath figures large as one of the main people being objected to. Neurath responded to that with a series of letters and an unpublished paper called Physicalism, Planning, and the Social Sciences, Bricks Prepared for Discussion with Hayek. I'm not sure what you meant by bricks here, as building an argument or throwing, but one of the two. Okay. What I want to pick up in this paper, I'll go through Hayek's criticisms, but is the shared concern that runs through those about the relationship. I mean, in the background here is the proper response to totalitarianism, right, which is what they share. And you find a shared commitment to a defense of pluralism and a competing claims about what the institutional conditions for pluralism are. So the debate, in short, I put there, is you get Hayek's criticisms of rationalistic assumptions of socialist planning. I'll run through those. I'll run through Neurath's response and his attempt to show how the shared commitments to forms of epistemic and practical pluralism. And then I'll finish by looking at their disagreement about what the answers are to the institutional conditions for practical pluralism. And that's where I want to get to. Right. Okay, before I start, however, right, and this is particularly true of pluralism, of Neurath, sorry, Neurath uses the term pluralism in a variety of different senses. And a lot of the time, I'll be straight, in Neurath, pluralism just uses this big slogan that he you know, you're a pluralist. Right. And it runs through his letters with Hayek, with Carnap, with G.D.H. Cole and others in the period. What I'm going to do just to start out with is just analytically do what Neurath doesn't do and just separate out the different senses of pluralism and just indicate some of the claims that are being made and the relationships between them as a background. So when I come to the later discussion of pluralism, it gives you some idea of what's being talked about. So I want to go through Neurath's different senses of pluralism. In the background here, in the foreground in modern debate is what might be called a liberal thesis about pluralism or conceptions of the good. That is that there exist a plurality of different conceptions of the good where one conception can't be shown to be more rationally defensible than any other. And that you get that kind of reasonable disagreement about different conceptions of the good is what underpins, for example, modern Rawlsian liberalism. Nothing like that is stated as such by Neurath or by Hayek, although both of them state something quite similar to that. The nearest you get into Neurath is what I've called, too longer terms, the pluralism of normative practices. That is, what Neurath concentrates on is the plurality of different ways of living a good life, a multiplicity of ways of life. And you find that commitment to that kind of pluralism right back to Neurath's early contributions to the socialization debates in 1918 and 1917, where he talks continuously, I'll come back to this later on, about the need to sustain multiplicity of different kinds of ways of living a good life. As part of that, and this became an increasing concern for Neurath in the 40s, is that he thought that different communities with their different ways of life had different vocabularies, not all of which were translatable into each other. So what he defended what might be called pluralism of language. And the doctrine of physicalism, which I'll come to later on, appears in the social and political writings at that point as a way of allowing for the possibility of conversation across different groups who have their different conception or different way of living a good life. A third conception that you find around, which I think is separate again, is what might be called welfare pluralism. That is that exists a plurality of different goods that constitute individual well-being or welfare. So he says, for example, in a 1937 paper on the standard of living, that the attempts to characterize the standard of living are like those that characterize the state of health. Both are multidimensional structures. And what you have in Neurath there is something which is quite close, I think, to Sen's kind of account of various functionings that make up a good life, capabilities for functionings. However, oddly, Neurath defends it from a broadly hedonistic perspective, and I'll come back to that later on. That welfare pluralism offers at least one ground for his pluralism of normative practices. That is, it offers the standard story that, given that you have a number of different goods that make up a good life, there are different ways in which those goods can be combined into a way of life, right? You can see how you might go from a kind of welfare pluralism to a kind of practical pluralism. Finally, this is on the practical side, you get a defense of institutional pluralism, is what I'll call it. That is that a good economic order will involve a plurality of different institutional forms. And this is going to be important for his later debates with Hayek. And that becomes central both to his criticisms of market economics and market economies. Neurath's in the background here is a kind of radical socialist of a very radical kind, but also his criticism of Bolshevik models of socialism, which go again back to the 1920s, where he defends a certain kind of pluralism, which sounds remarkably modern, actually, in its statement. That institutional pluralism is taken as a way of realizing people living a plurality of different ways of living, multiplicity of way of living, and a way of realising welfare pluralism. There's different ways people can realise the constituents of welfare. Alongside that, and this is kind of important again for his debates with Hayek, and which come now more centrally to the philosophy of science, and I think partly defensible and partly indefensible claims that Neurath makes about the philosophy of science, he sees that defense, he also defends what might be called a form of cognitive pluralism and practical pluralism, and these are related to each other. The cognitive pluralism I've called here belief pluralism. That is the view that there's a plurality of different beliefs that is consistent with empirical evidence. And there's two versions of that claim. There's a kind of moderate version or a weak version, and then there's a very strong version, which I personally think is indefensible. I'm happy to talk about this. I think this is what the debates with Carnap came about. The weak version is simply that empirical evidence doesn't determine a particular belief as true or false. It's a kind of underdetermination thesis. The strong, which is what I call BP1 here, the strong version is that there's simply no truth singular to be determined. Right. The rejection of the idea that is, you know, sciences converge on a single truth. And that's what really comes out in the debates, I mean, the correspondence between Neurath and Carnap in the 43 and 1944, which is really about Popper. And it's Neurath going around saying Popper, he does this to Hayek as well, Popper is essentially anti-pluralistic, he says. Right. And he tells off Hayek for, you know, he's saying, what are you doing going around with this Popper guy, right, who's this, and, you know, this anti-pluralistic absolutist when you should be in with someone like me who's pluralist through and through. And the reason why he takes Popper to be for non-pluralist, I think it's two reasons. First of all, it's the kind of what might be called a methodological monism, that there's a way of eliminating, right, methodologically all, you know, falsehoods. So it's the kind of, there's something very close to kind of, and Feyerabend refers back to this, something close to what Feyerabend defends later on with that kind of methodological pluralism. But he also, more strongly, says that what's wrong with Popper's, why Popper's anti-pluralistic is because he thinks there is a truth, singular, to be discovered. So he says about pluralism of empiricism, this is a quote from his letters to Carnap now, says, more than one theory possible when we see one acceptable, more than one history of the world possible given any empiricist frame. And Neurath then gets really radical then, and he says, and Tarski as well is all metaphysics, right? Yeah. So it gets generalized into Tarski. So he says, Aristotelian metaphysics on the true is connected with the anti-pluralist point of view. And Carnap there, I think, responds that kind of radical pluralism that he's defending there isn't required. And I can talk about a bit, you know, for his more moderate kind of versions of pluralism, about especially his more moderate decision pluralism. And I'll come back to that in discussion if people want to follow it up. I think it's a really interesting kind of debate that happens there, partly around the definition of true the definition of truth and its role in the sciences. Alongside that cognitive pluralism, there's also then a practical pluralism, which I've called decision pluralism here, which is kind of mirrors the belief pluralism that I've just outlined. So he says there's a plurality of rational different decisions that's consistent with given empirical and base and a set of rational decision-making principles. And that can take, again, a weak form or a strong form. So the weak form is simply that says that empirical beliefs and rational decision-making procedures don't determine a particular optimal outcome. Right, so it's saying that the decision procedures themselves don't determine optimal outcome. The stronger claim is that there's no optimal outcome to be determined. Right, the notion of a decision optimum is a mistake, right, especially when applied to kind of social decision making. And Neurath defends both of those claims, right, and he defends them basically partly on the basis of his cognitive pluralism, the weak and the strong forms I've mentioned, and partly on the basis of his welfare pluralism, about the multiplicity of constituents of welfare. The debates with Carnap partly focus on how far you need the very strong cognitive claim to underpin the strong decision claim. Right. And then, again, I can talk about this in discussion afterwards, but it seems to me on that debate, Carnap is right. I don't think you need something as strong as his claim that there's no truth singular to be determined to get the kind of decision pluralism that he's looking for. The term that Neurath uses to describe people that are committed to forms of cognitive pluralism and practical pluralism is pseudo-rationalism. And the concept of pseudo-rationalism is central to Neurath's work, and it goes back to an early 1930 paper called The Lost Wanderers of Descartes. And I basically, in his later writings at least, I think that forms of decision pluralism and cognitive pluralism more or less define what pseudo-rationalism is for Neurath. If you hold those, then you're a pseudo-rationalist. Right. What he thinks about Descartes is Descartes recognised, if you like, practical pluralism, but didn't recognise the cognitivist pluralism. Okay, that's just to highlight the different pluralist claims that Neurath is making in abstract, analytically, just so that when we come to talk about Neurath later on, I can kind of refer back to them in places. Okay, then, on to the debate then between Hayek and Neurath. In the essay Scientism and the Study of Society and Economic, and I'll just run through Hayek's arguments here. Hayek writes in the early 1940s. Hayek rejects two main sets of claims which are relevant to Neurath. First of all, he rejects scientism. That is, the extension of the methods of natural sciences beyond their proper scope. And with that, I'll come to this in a moment, he rejects physicalism, objectivism, and an engineering mentality. So it's the general extension of an engineering mentality into the social sphere beyond the proper scope of engineering or extension of the scope of science beyond its proper sphere into the social sphere. Related to that, he rejects what he calls an in natura calculation. That is, and he takes this really from Neurath, it's Neurath's the object of criticism here. That is the idea that economic choices could be based on reckoning in kind rather than in terms of monetary units. And that becomes central to the debate then between Neurath and Hayek. And Neurath becomes the primary target for Hayek's criticism. So all the faults that you can think for Hayek all kind of converge on Neurath. So he defends objectivism, socialism, and in natura calculation. So here's a couple of quotes, one from the essay and one from a later interview. He says, "The most persistent advocate of in natura calculation is significantly Dr. Otto Neurath, the protagonist of modern physicalism objectivism." And he says later in an interview, "What dissuaded me of positivism is that the social scientist, the science specialist in the tradition of Otto Neurath, was just so extreme and so naive in economics. It was actually through them that I became aware that positivism was just as misleading in the social sciences. I owe it to Neurath's extreme position that I recognised that it wouldn't do." And then you get Neurath's response. Okay, just run through some of the central arguments there very briefly that Hayek introduces. First of all, against objectivism. Objectivism in this context, and it's used in a variety of different ways in Austrian economics, but in this context is the view that the social sciences require the elimination of all terms that couldn't be given a characterization in physical terms. And in particular, the elimination of mental vocabulary, or what we might now say, an intentional vocabulary. And that view is to be typified by Neurath's physicalist program, which I'll come to later on. And against that, you then have subjectivism, but in this context is the view that the objects of social sciences cannot be characterized in purely physical terms. They require reference to mental states. So the objects of social science are constituted by beliefs or ideas, is the term that Hayek uses, that individuals have about them. So he says, quote, "Neither a commodity or an economic good, nor belief, nor food can be defined in physical terms, but only in terms of the views that people hold about things." In the background to his rejection of objectivism is Hayek's worries about, this is the kind of practical upshot of it, is the worries about what he calls in natura calculation. That is the possibility of doing socialist planning using physical units. That's the background concern. So he talks about the characteristic and ever-recurrent demand for the substitution of in natura calculation for the artificial calculation in terms of price or value, that is, of the calculation which takes explicit account of the objective property of things. That quote captures the position he's rejecting. So he's rejecting generally the idea of socialist calculation on the basis of physical units, which includes the kind of energy units that ecological economists, early ecological economists were using, like Oswald Soddy and Solomon. Both that belief in objectivism and in natural calculation were an expression of an illusion about the scope of knowledge and reason that's typical of socialist planning generally, but gets embodied for Hayek in the figure of the social engineer. Right. And the rationalist illusions of socialist planning that's embodied in that figure of the social engineer involves two central errors, which leads to the famous road to serfdom for Hayek. One is the rejection of pluralism, the second, the possibility of complete knowledge. So first of all, then, he takes social engineering to involve the idea that the social engineer, the planner, has a single end or hierarchy of end in terms of which he can plan optimally for the realization of that end. So, quote, he says he will be concerned with a single end, control of all the efforts directed towards this end, and dispose of this purpose over a definitely given supply of resources. That claim that social choices can be made on the basis of a single end is taken to be incompatible with a liberal politics. Right, so this is where Hayek is invoking a kind of classical liberalism. In the background, there's also a second assumption, which is typical of the social engineer, which is the idea that you can gather together all the knowledge that's required to plan to realise that optimum outcome. So he says, quote again, the application of the engineering technique to the whole society requires that the director possess the same complete knowledge of the whole society that engineer possesses of his limited world. Central economic planning is nothing but such an application of engineering principles to the whole of society based on the assumption that a complete concentration of all relevant knowledge is possible. Both of those claims for Hayek, the rejection of pluralism, and particularly the assumption of the possibility of complete knowledge, embody for him the kind of the error of rationalism that underpins the socialist project. And against that, there's this famous passage where he says it may be proved to be the most difficult, not least the most important task for human reason to rationally comprehend its own limitations. So the problem of the rationalist here is the overextension of the domain of rational decision-making procedures and the domain of claims about their epistemic, an absence of claims of their epistemic limits. Against the assumption of complete knowledge, he invokes two sources of human ignorance in the social domain, at least. One of which is the division of knowledge in society. And that's not just the fact that knowledge is divided, it's the fact that that knowledge often takes a practical... It's a form of practical knowledge which can't be articulated in propositional form, and it's knowledge that's local to time and place that can't be presented in universal form that can be centralised into a central planning agency. So it's the non-articulability of a variety of social knowledge that's required for planning. Secondly, there's the necessary unpredictability of future wants. Right, and here there's something like Popper's argument against historicism, that if you could predict the content of future knowledge, you'd already have it. So the content of future knowledge is necessarily unpredictable. Right. Against the rationalist illusion, then, Hayek says that markets resolve the problems of coordination in the context of pluralism and the absence of the possibility of concentrating complete knowledge. So in terms of coordination, markets allow you to coordinate without agreeing on ends. So again, a quote, this is from a later work. The great society arose through the discovery that men can live together in peace and mutually benefiting each other without agreeing on the particular aims they severally pursue. The discovery that by substituting abstract rules of conduct for obligatory concrete ends made it possible to extend the order and peace beyond small groups pursuing the same ends, because it enabled each individual to gain from the skill and knowledge of others whom he need not even know and whose aims may be wholly different from his own. So the idea is, in through market exchange, we don't have to agree on any ends. I pursue my aims, you pursue your aims, and we can coordinate our activities accordingly. Secondly, the market allows coordination without the centralization of knowledge. Through the price mechanism, each individual can coordinate their activities just using their own particular bit of knowledge, and the price mechanism communicates that knowledge that I need to mutually coordinate my activities with others. Okay, so that's the Hayekian argument in outline against Neurath. So Neurath's social engineering then embodies this huge mistake, this huge rationalist illusion. Neurath's response, there's two central moves in that response. First of all, there's three central moves. First of all, there's a kind of clarification of the central terms in the debate, physicalism and immature calculation. I'll run through that briefly. Secondly, there's an appeal in Neurath to the claim that really we share the same epistemic assumptions. So we're on the same side. So Neurath's constantly saying, you know, what are you doing, for example, with Popper, when it's me and us empiricists that really you should be agreeing with. And thirdly, he appeals to common commitments with Hayek to a pluralist alternative to totalitarianism. First of all, then, physicalism. The clarification of physicalism. Physicalism, says Neurath, in the sense that he's using it, isn't an attempt to reduce social or mental vocabulary to that of physics, or to eliminate intentional vocabulary or mental terms from the social sciences. So he says, I never tried to explain in his letter to Hayek, I never tried to explain mental processes by physical ones because I do not have the means in my language to distinguish between mental and physical. All my terms are when, where, how terms. Therefore, what Professor von Hayek and others call mental appear manifestly in my language as speech, behavior, or arguing, i.e. good, when, where, when, and how item. And the crucial thing for physicalism there for Neurath is the where and the when. I think the how comes in after. What he means by physicalism, that all statements of the social sciences and everyday life should be capable of translation into terms that refer to spatio-temporal particulars. Right. The answer to the questions where and when. Right. The how appears in these letters, which I think is interesting. I'm not sure quite how it relates to the more general claims about the importance of spatio-temporal particulars and where and the when. And that physicalism kind of captures Neurath's empiricism. So he says, physicalism, as I suggested, it starts from everyday language, which avoids elements which various people on Earth do not have in common. The assumption is that Milesian tribes and European explorers can start to talk on cows and calves, pains and pleasures without difficulties, where difficulties appear with expressions like cause, punishment, mind, etc. In part of our everyday language, which physicalism acknowledges, one can formulate questions where, when, how. So that's the physicalist doctrine that Neurath's claim. Yeah. And we can talk about that later. In natura calculation, again, Neurath doesn't deny that he thinks you can have planning in natura, but he doesn't think that means a reduction to physicalist units, like energy. Right. The notion, the components of well-being that Neurath appeals to are multidimensional and social. So he'll talk about humiliation, for example, as being a harm. Or freedom being a central social good. So he's not assuming a kind of purely physicalist account in the sense of physicalism that that Hayek takes him to hold. And more generally, he holds that there's no single scale of values, in particular a physical scale of values, in terms of which losses in one dimension of welfare can be measured in terms of gains in others. So there's part of the multidimensionality of various components of well-being. Turning to complete knowledge and epistemic criticism, the big complaint that runs through the letters is the complaint that he holds the same criticism of the idea that you could have complete knowledge. Right. So he quote from the letters, I am the arch enemy of the illusion of complete knowledge. And from this point of view, I think Professor von Hayek should praise me and appreciate my never-ceasing efforts to destroy such illusions. And you find there, and this goes back a long way to the arguments about pseudo-rationalism, which I talked about earlier on, a common rejection of Cartesian rationalism. So if you go back to that 1913 paper I mentioned earlier on, you get something which is very similar to the claim that Hayek echoes unconsciously later on. Neurath says, rationalism sees its chief triumphs in the clear recognition of the limits of actual insight. So the criticisms of pseudo-rationalism involve, you know, forms of cognitive and practical pluralism. And you get this in a paper that came out in 1946. This is a long quote, so I'll read it out and then give you an idea of how he sees the two things related. So he says, even before the First World War, this is referring back to his 13 paper now, I realised that acknowledging a kind of primary pluralism in our scientific approach has also its consequences for our daily life. If science enables us to make more than one sound prediction, how may we use science as a means of action? We can never afford a decision because no account would be able to show one action as the best. No computation would present us with any optimum, whatever actions have to be discussed. Therefore, decision plays its part in a kind of research as well as all our daily life. That is the reason why I have stressed unpredictability as the essential element of empiricism, thus repudiating all attempts to use unequivocal historical predictions as the basis of social actions. Okay, so he kind of, and this runs through the letters, of kind of saying, I share your rejection of the illusion of complete knowledge and the idea that there is an optimum which we can all converge upon. And that's related then third to the kind of practical pluralism, right, which he claims also accepts. So against the idea that planning involves a single end, in terms of which you can define an optimum, he goes out of his ways to claim that there is no such single best solution. So he says, again in his letters to Hayek, of course there are people, I call them pseudo-rationalists, who try to present us with the one and only one best solution as a scientific one. And I agree with you that this pseudo-rationalism is dangerous and may sometimes support totalitarianism. But I think you should at least mention there is a scientific attitude represented by logical empiricism which is pluralist through and through. And there's a kind of appeal in the background there to both the welfare pluralism and the decision pluralism, which I outlined earlier on. Similarly, there's a concern with the kind of institutional conditions for a pluralism of ways of life, what I call the pluralism of normative practices. So he says again, Professor von Hayek thinks of planning exclusively in something dictatorial, right? I do not know why. In my articles, Planning for Freedom, I've tried to stress the point that planning may be connected with the suppression of individuals hardly heard of before, but also enable us to be free to an extent hardly heard before. Free, i.e. a multiplicity of ways of life possible, non-conformism supported by the planned institutions. So you get then, we've taken too long to say all of this, you get then basically Neurath coming back saying, I agree, Hayek, with all of your claims about knowledge and about pluralism. Where they disagree, and this is where I want to focus now for the rest of the talk, is on what the institutional conditions are for realising that kind of institutional pluralism. What are the institutional structures that are required to allow individuals to live together and coordinate their activities, given that they've got different conceptions of the ends of life and different ways of living a good life? And the central difference here is, I think, that Hayek has a fundamentally non-discursive response to that. Right? The thing for Hayek about markets is it allows people with different ways of living a good life to get along with each other and to coordinate their activities without having to enter into any conversation about those ways of life. Right? We simply engage in market activities. So in market institutions allow each individual to gain from the skills and knowledge of others who do not even need to know, right, and whose aims could be different from his own. Neurath, going back very early on in his writings, this is going back to the socialization debates in the early 1920s, rejects that kind of market solution because he basically sees markets as incompatible in practice with a variety of ways of living a different good life. So you get very early in Neurath a kind of rejection of Bolshevik socialism for imposing the same kind of monism that he associates with the spread of global markets. So I'll just give you a typical quote here. He says, for example, should China, India, Central Africa really get one and the same socialism? Each comparative study of different orders of life teaches us that the tendency to organize economy in all civilizations after the same pattern which made the free market society so much hated. If socialism should bring liberation, it must be joined by tolerance, it must do justice to the differences in civilizations and fit each other into an economic plan or administrative economy in its own ways. And later on you get Manchester liberalism, right, for example, associated with a rejection of the possibility of living a variety of different ways of good life. That kind of gets reflected, this is in the early 20s now, gets reflected in the 40s in especially a paper called International Planning for Freedom, where you get very much a kind of central claim that comes into later discussions of totalitarianism, that the source of totalitarianism is that people can't have more than one loyalty. Right. So he talks about, you know, in a dictatorial society, one-party state, there is a tendency for one and only loyalty to devour all others, and loyalties are not permitted to grow side by side. So Neurath then, on the one, you know, he's committed to a similar pluralism, but he thinks in practice markets aren't, this is kind of an empirical observation now, whether this holds, we can talk about in discussion, tend to be inimical to a certain kind of pluralism. And in Neurath's response, in contrast to Hayek's, tends to be discursive rather than non-discursive. That is, he thinks the coordination of action requires what he calls a social lingua franca, through which people with different ways of living a life can arrive at common decisions at the point of action. And here, the doctrine of physicalism reappears as the language required for social coordination. And I've given you a long quote there from a paper on humanism and education. But what you have there at the end, he says, he talks about, you know, a language of science being a common language where we use the term scientific in its wider sense. So he talks about variety within a community has to be based on some structure of society, and therefore we have to look at the social elements which enable contact between human beings from group to group throughout the world and communication and understanding. It is manifest that a certain amount of trust is needed for a successful cooperation and the possibility to make contact through language. If one language should not be used, then languages which are partially translatable to each other, into each other are wanted. What we call science may be regarded as a typical branch of arguing in which human beings of all nations, rich and poor, have in common. When you get the familiar physicalism, discussions of the sun, moon, stars, anatomy, geography, pleasure, pain can be carried out in any civilization, whereas theology and legal terms are mainly local. In the field of scientific talks, all human beings cooperate, whereby we use the term scientific in a wider sense. Just want to raise two Hayekian objections to that kind of position, two obvious responses a Hayekian might make. One is that this is typical of Neurath's scientism. Right, what you have in the background here is the kind of picture of technocratic experts sitting around talking the language of science, which is the kind of common world against a kind of background of cultural plurality. So it's putting science and scientific language in the centre. It's a kind of scientific vision of experts inhabiting planning boards talking to each other. That's one objection. Second objection, I'll run through that, and I think the basic objection isn't particularly serious, but I think there's versions of it which are more important and which show up limitations in Hayek's position. The second objection is an epistemic one, right? That is, the argument roughly goes that Neurath's position is open to exactly the same objections that Hayek raises against centralized planning. So if you've got a dispersal of local knowledge which can't be articulated in propositional form, that's going to be true. That's a problem not just for centralized planning, but for any discursive form of coordination. Because any form of discursive coordination of action is going to require that we can articulate those claims in propositional form. And that's not going to be possible if there's this kind of local practical knowledge which can't be thus articulated. And you get that Hayekian argument, for example, recently used against various versions of deliberative democracy, and I'll come back to that. So they're the two objections. What I want to do in the rest of the paper is run through those objections and respond, partly articulate them and partly respond to them. First of all, then, the objection about scientism. That is the potential technocratic narrowness of the basis that Neurath offers for public conversation. Response to that, I think, is in the terms that I've just stated it, it's unfair to Neurath. What's crucial there is the term, you know, the use of the term scientific in its widest sense, or wider sense. So the term scientific here isn't being used narrowly to refer to the language of the special sciences, but to be used more generally to use it for any kind of everyday jargon, which refers to spatio-temporal particulars. So it's that generalised physicalism, which we already talked about, the Milesians and the explorer, what they have in common that matters here. However, I think that there is versions of the scientism objection which still might have force against Neurath. And they are, I mean, basically problems of cultural neutrality and problems of value neutrality. I'll just run through those the first one very briefly and the second one in more detail. First one is, it's not clear, I'm going to state this, against cultural neutrality, once you understand physicalist language in that sense, of just talking about spatio-temporal particulars, it's not clear to me that moving to a physicalist language of that kind avoids the problems of communication across different cultures and communications. So it seems to me there can be misunderstandings just as much when you talk about cows and calves between a Hindu and someone in a McDonald's, you know, burger joint, right, as there can be about theology and abstract claims, right, yeah. So there can be just as much misunderstanding of cows, calves, sun, moon, stars, pleasures and pains as there is of cause and punishment, to take his term. So the meaning of those terms will not be culturally neutral, and I don't think the physicalist move will work for Hayek. Sorry, for Neurath, given his aims. Secondly, concerning value neutrality, crucial feature, and this is where I think he is scientistic in the old sense, through and through, is that physicalism for Neurath is intended to be value neutral. So Neurath's a non-cognitivist about value, and physicalism is going to involve the elimination of value-loaded terms from conversation. And in doing that, Neurath makes two standard moves. I mean, you can recognise this from, you know, I kind of recognise this from when I did philosophy of social sciences a long time ago. Right. You get the move of relativising value terms to speakers and communities, and hence in the language of common conversation, they are to be eliminated. So he says a term like justice is to relativise as follows. St. Neurath says, just according to the rules of a certain nation or tribe at a certain date. So you try and, if you've got problems about using the term justice, you simply say justice according to that particular group. And then you make it into an empirical term, right, because it's descriptive. Or secondly, he says you eliminate normative terms or equivalents that lack normative, for terms that lack normative force. So he says, we propose to avoid praising and blaming words in articles and books on history. One man kills another man, he does not murder or assassinate him. I think neither of those moves work for standard reasons. So if you take the relativization of terms to the group studied, big problem there is the group studies themselves disagree and contest those terms. So it seems to me it's not clear how local you can get here if you're studying a society. And secondly, on terms of the elimination of normative terms, it seems to me that you can't eliminate normative terms without the possibility of loss of information. So there's a difference between, for example, talking about the Archduke of Ferdinand being killed as starting the First World War, or being assassinated starting the First World War. Assassination carries information that kills does not. There's also, I think, and this is what comes through in the letters with G.D.H. Cole, an internal problem for Neurath himself. So Neurath, in practice, doesn't employ a value-free specification of the conditions of life when he sets up his social silhouette. So he tries to do welfare comparisons by having the kind of multidimensional social silhouettes of different dimensions of life, right, that make up a good standard of living. So Neurath's account of the conditions of human welfare aren't as I've already said, aren't physicalist in the sense that Hayek understands them. And in the specification, he uses thick normative terms. So he says, for example, a change in man's food and shelter is of less importance than a state of being bullied or humiliated by a certain institutions. And he talks about self-government and freedom or other relations being happiness conditions of human beings. Notions like bullied or being humiliated carry normative force. Neurath's response to that is basically a form of hedonism. So it's interesting that the terms of pleasure and pain in the background always comes into a kind of physicalist vocabulary. But again, it strikes me that so far as those terms have normative force, right, there's a lot of work being going on. You know, I mean, I don't think you can... so far as they're welfare terms, right, they're carrying a normative force beyond simply a physicalist description. And the theorist who really pushes this out is G.D.H. Cole in his letters with Neurath. And I'll run through Cole briefly and then Neurath's response and say why I think Neurath is wrong. Right, so Cole says against Neurath in correspondence, "I do not think the results of looking things in this way, quote, one is left simply with a number of diverse patterns, such as one can say, here is pattern A and here is pattern B and so on, and leave it at that. I think that a pattern can be good or bad in the same sense that a work of art can be good or bad. This is a kind of pattern of conditions of well-being. What it cannot be is the good or, of course, the bad. In other words, there may be no single thing which one can say, this is absolutely and in all circumstances good. But there may be patterns in which one may say, this pattern is very much better than that. And this implies a standard of judgment, that is a valuation, which I believe to be indispensable and yet incapable of being reduced to scientific terms. I'm not sure how far you agree with this, but which amounts in my mind to a pluralistic conception of values, which still remain values, though not referable to a single unique standard." So Cole is saying we've got to be pluralist about values, but let's recognise that these are values, right? And we can't eliminate them if we're doing welfare comparisons across different societies, right? Neurath's response is to say, I'll just quote it, he says, "Should you agree with me in any case that we are using the terms good or bad, we can use them only in addition for somebody. When you add that we have to describe what kinds of pleasure, happiness you want to include, then we shall reach statements of this type. Should we alter the social actions from A to B, that the happiness of group A will increase and the happiness of group Y will decrease. The descriptions of increasing or decreasing happiness, as vague as it may be possible, is a scientific and empiricist statement as any other." Right. End of quote. I'm not sure that response of Neurath works, right? What it looks like to me is a version of his relativizing strategy. So he's saying, you know, what we say is it's good for this group or bad for this group. But here, talking about X is good for A, in welfare terms, I think trades on an ambiguity. So there's two ways of understanding a phrase, X is good for A, for understanding welfare in the welfare context. There's what I call here an intentional reading and an extensional reading. So I'll give you my example and then I'll just throw in another one I saw recently. So the intentional, I take lard is good for John. Right. The intentional reading is something like, for John, lard is good, right? Or John believes that lard is good. Right. So that's sort of relativizing it. That's the relativizing strategy. The extensional reading would be something like, lard improves John's conditions of life. Here's another example. This is, I suppose it was ludicrous. I'll just say that this came across in a quote I discovered recently on organic food. Someone asked the question, is organic food good for you? Right. And some producers of organic food said, well, it depends what your beliefs are. Right, yeah. Which sounds an odd response to me, right, to that question. However, there's a perfectly good sense of it, well, where it simply says, is it good for you? Meaning, do you believe it's good? Right, that's the intentional reading. Right. What most people are interested in is whether it actually improved your condition of life, the extensional reading. That's what does the work in kind of welfare comparisons. And Neurath, insofar as he's doing welfare comparison, relies on the extensional reading, not the intentional reading. The relativizing strategy requires an intentional reading. Right. So I think that Neurath's kind of move here simply doesn't work. And what's actually going on in Neurath where it comes to welfare is a kind of naturalism about value of of normative welfare terms. Okay, so I think going back to the scientism objection, I think that some of the scientism objection sticks, right? And it seems to me that Neurath's physicalism may not be able to do all he claims it can do. So I think there is something in that response, though not in the crude form I first stated it. Turning to the epistemic response then, the argument here would go that Neurath's, this is the Hayekian argument, would go that Neurath's non-market discursive coordination is open to the same objections as that Hayek aimed against centralised planning. So Hayek's arguments against centralised planning don't simply appeal to the division of knowledge about amongst different actors, but the nature of the knowledge that's dispersed. So it's practical knowledge that's embodied in the skills and know-how that can't be articulated in a general propositional form. So if you have practical forms of knowledge that can't be passed on to a central planning system in virtue of not being able to be articulated in propositional form, then it can't be articulated in any deliberative setting, any discursive setting. So models of economic decision-making or coordination of the kind that Neurath presents, which are discursive, are necessarily are going to eliminate certain forms of practical knowledge. They're going to have to be open to the same objections as you have to centralised planning. Right. Hence, the argument goes that you require markets to resolve those problems. Two different claims here I just want to separate out. First one is the claim that no purely discursive institutions for coordination of action could capture practical knowledge of dispersed actors. Second claim is that market institutions are necessary to coordinate those actions. I just want to separate those, to coordinate that knowledge or actions. I want to separate those two claims out. First claim that there's no purely discursive institutions is one that Neurath accepts, right? And he says that at various points. The real argument is around the second claim, right? That is that markets are necessary. And it's a kind of market monism that Hayek assumes here, that to coordinate practical knowledge of that kind, you require market mechanisms. And in response to that, I think Neurath has, I think, two interesting lines of argument, which I think retain contemporary significance. First one is a kind of ubiquity problem, that the epistemic problem that Hayek raises is everywhere, right? It's not just in the kind of economic sphere of market. And secondly, an argument from the institutional conditions for coordination of scientific knowledge, the role that science in particular begins to play in Neurath's argument. First of all, then, the ubiquity problem. So he says, Professor von Hayek thinks that people think too much of the society as a factory, as if we were able to predict so much better in a factory. I want to stress the point that in a factory we're not able to predict as comprehensively as Professor von Hayek thinks. I have to over Hayek, Professor I. Hayek. We're not in a position for comprehensive prediction there either. So the point there that Neurath's making is even in the factory, right, yeah, you require the coordination of dispersed practical knowledge. And I think there's an important point here, which I'll leave for discussion, which is the absence of a theory of the firm in Austrian economic tradition. Right. That is, you have within market economies islands of hierarchic coordination, which are firms, in which you have the dispersal of practical knowledge. Right. And one of the big problems in a knowledge economy is actually how do you coordinate within a firm that kind of practical knowledge. What I think is interesting as far as Hayek's concerned, to state this and then leave it for discussion, is on the one hand, I think, this is why Austrians have such problems with it. On the one hand, he gives you a very interesting basis for starting to understand the issue of coordination of that kind of practical knowledge. But what he actually talks about in the economic sphere is simply markets. And clearly the firm is a non-market sphere within a larger market context. So I think Neurath's ubiquity problem raises a problem that's become central to later Austrian economics, which is the problem of the absence of a theory of firm. Second issue, which I also find interesting, is the role of science as a form of unification of knowledge. And this is where we come to the central problem, project in the Vienna Circle of Neurath was pressing, was the project for the unity of the sciences. For Neurath, that becomes central in the debates with Hayek, because science itself is a form of non-market, non-centralized social coordination.
Right.
And it comes to the fore in debates with Callan that he had in the 40s, where Callan's saying this unity of the science is itself a kind of totalitarian project, and Neurath coming back and saying, no, it isn't.
Right.
And he says in one of those things, it's project concerned with, quote, how much unity of action can result without any kind of authoritative integration. A few points there about unified science. One issue is that, the picture of unified science here, just to remind people, isn't the classic picture of scientific reductionism, of social sciences to psychology to biology to so on, the kind of reduction to physics. Neurath explicitly rejects what he calls scientific pyramidism of that kind. What you get instead is what he calls the orchestration of the sciences through unified language, which, I'll leave this out here for reasons of time, Supes interestingly rejects, had a kind of influential objection to this by saying, I'll read it out actually because it's about the pluralism, that it's not true, the development of science doesn't require that unified language of science. Supes says, personally I applaud the divergence of language in the science and find in it no grounds for scepticism or pessimism about the growth of science. The irreducible pluralism of language of science is a desirable feature as the irreducible plurality of political views on democracy. Right. I think there's a problem with that Supes quote. I'll just say that. There's a difference between pluralism of views and pluralism of languages. However, I think, understood in the way that Neurath meant it, there's nothing in Neurath's position that says that you can't have the kind of disunity of language that Supes is talking about there. Physicalism happens at the point of action. Right, yeah. So what he wants to say, the role of the unified language is more minimal than Supes suggests. At the point of action, you have to orchestrate the sciences. What I think Supes gets right, I'll just state this, is that Neurath is much more, it's too concerned about the linguistic conditions for unity rather than the social conditions for unity. And I'll talk about that in conversation, if you like. What I think remains powerful about Neurath's model of science in relation to Hayek is that as a social model, science does provide, through peer processes, coordination of knowledge without market mechanisms. And I'll just finish by saying, this is just coming to really interesting, I think, current debates by people like Benkler about what he calls commons-based peer production, is how that model of peer-based production is being central to various forms of knowledge production that through the World Wide Web and the Creative Commons at present. So Benkler talks about, I'll just again quote, commons-based peer production as a socio-economic system for production that's emerging in a digitally networked environment, facilitated by technical infrastructure of the internet. The hallmark of this socio-technical system is a collaboration among large groups of individuals, sometimes in orders of tens or even hundreds of thousands, who cooperate effectively to provide information, knowledge, or cultural goods without relying on either market pricing or managerial hierarchies to coordinate their common enterprise. So you think of things like the Linux system as it's developed. What I think Benkler is right about that is that it's interestingly non-firm based and it's not market based, right? But you have the coordination of knowledge and information across large numbers of groups. If you look at the kind of theory, the people that have been involved in developing that, what I find again interesting about that is a lot of them are Hayekian in inspiration. So you get these appeals back to Hayek. I actually think they're Neurathian in their actual form. Right. So this, I think that would be very close to the kind of picture of social coordination that Neurath was looking for. And I'll stop there. I'm sorry if I've gone too long. So thank you.